Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight, investigating the insurrection. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi rejects two Republican nominees to serve on the committee reviewing the Capitol assault. Then, summer surge. A spike in cases raises new concerns. We try to answer basic COVID questions at this critical moment. And searching for justice, a unique summer camp aims to maintain connections between daughters and their currently or formerly incarcerated mothers.
The love between the mothers and daughters in our program is unconditional. You know, they're our mamas. They're much more than a seven-digit prison number.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The special congressional committee tasked with investigating the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol is embroiled in a new partisan firestorm tonight. At issue, which Republican members will be allowed to participate? House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has the final say over who sits on the panel, and today announced she would reject two of the five members suggested by Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. In her statement, Pelosi cited objections raised about Representatives Jim Banks and Jim Jordan and the impact their appointments may have on the integrity of the investigation. McCarthy hit back, saying that if Banks and Jordan could not serve, then none of them would. And he charged Pelosi and Democrats with an abuse of power.
House Democrats must answer this question. Why are you allowing a lame duck speaker to destroy this institution? This is the people's house, not Pelosi's house.
And now the sole Republican on the Select Committee, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, condemned her party's leader, but said it will not deter the remaining members from completing their work.
And at every opportunity, the minority leader has attempted to prevent the American people from understanding what happened, to block this investigation. This investigation must go forward. The idea that anybody would be playing politics with an attack on the United States Capitol is despicable and is disgraceful.
And here to piece together this day's events and where we go from here, our Lisa Desjardins. She is at the Capitol now. So hello, Lisa. You spoke to all the players involved in this today. Take us through the decision, surprising decision made by the speaker on such a high-profile issue.
Quite an unusual decision and an unusual day here, Judy. First of all, to explain to viewers, Pelosi was able to do this because she herself set up this committee as a select committee of the House. And in the bill that set up this committee, it gave her the power to veto any of the Republicans' choices from Mr. McCarthy. She used that power today. And I want to look at exactly who we're talking about. Leader McCarthy made five appointments. If you look at the five faces of the people who were he wanted on the committee, there they are. Two of them, as you said, Jim Jordan and then also Jim Banks there at the top left, were the ones that she had issues with. The other three were going to be allowed to remain on the committee, but they have, in fact, said they will not participate now. Now, so why Banks and Jordan specifically? That's the question we've all been asking. Now, Jordan, you should know, is someone who is seen potentially as a material witness in this case because he did work with President Trump's legal team on questions about the certification of the election. Now, as for these two men, one reason this is raising a lot of eyebrows is because of their positions within the House. I want to talk a little bit about that. Jim Jordan, as many of our viewers will know, is the number one Republican, the ranking Republican on the Judiciary Committee. And then Jim Banks, also someone behind the scenes who's very important. He chairs the Republican Study Committee, which is the largest caucus. The majority of Republicans are in that group. Both of them did vote to object to the election results on January 6th after the insurrection. But there were others named who also objected that Pelosi didn't remove. Jim Banks, why was he rejected by Pelosi? He's someone who's not seen as throwing punches the way that Jim Jordan is. I'm told it's because of a statement that Mr. Banks, Representative Banks, made earlier this week about the committee itself. Let's take a look at this. This was his statement in becoming the ranking member on the committee. He wrote that, make no mistake, Nancy Pelosi created this committee solely to malign conservatives. Now, on the one hand, this is actual normal partisan rhetoric in these very heated times, but talking to those around Speaker Pelosi, they say this was her call, and they really want a serious investigation here. Their conclusion was that Representative Banks and Representative Jordan would not be serious, would not lead to a serious investigation. However, of course, they differ. They say this is partisan tactics, that Democrats are going to use this issue in the next election. And they say, essentially, this is a sham by Pelosi. I asked her, how does she respond to being called someone playing politics? She told me these exact words, Judy. She said, perhaps you've mistaken me for someone who cares about that. So she doesn't really care about what Republicans are saying about her. She's focused on what this committee is right now and what it will do.
So, Lisa, where does this leave the investigation into January 6th? And we know there's such high tension already between the two parties over that.
That's right. There will now be two investigations. Republican leader McCarthy said his group will lead their own investigation. We don't really know details of that yet. But the other group, including Liz Cheney and then the seven Democrats with her, will go forward with their investigation as planned. No timeline for that either. That first hearing is next week. But I have to say, all of this really just inflames those tensions I keep talking about that are just beneath the surface. I spoke to Democrats today who are angry. Overall rank and file members, though, I think both are disappointed. Both sides know this is a fragile time where they want to talk about things like infrastructure. But this kind of day leads to problems on almost every issue.
Lisa Desjardins reporting from the Capitol. Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome.
In the day's other news, Republicans in the U.S. Senate blocked debate on a bipartisan infrastructure plan. The bill, worth $1.2 trillion, is not finished, but it would fund roads, bridges, broadband, and other projects. Democratic leaders said that a procedural vote would speed things up. Republicans argued it was premature, and they spoke ahead of the tally.
We are now in the fourth week of negotiations since the bipartisan group of senators reached an agreement with the White House on an infrastructure framework. 4 weeks. According to the negotiators, spurred on by this vote this afternoon, they are close to finalizing their product.
There's no outcome yet. No bipartisan agreement. No text. Nothing for the Congressional Budget Office to evaluate. And certainly nothing on which to vote. Not yet.
Negotiators say the bill could be ready by early next week, and there could be another vote then. More than a dozen states have reached a legal settlement over opioid abuse worth $26 billion in their lawsuits against major U.S. distributors and drug maker Johnson & Johnson. Today's announcement says the companies would pay the money over 18 years. They would not admit to any wrongdoing. We'll take a closer look later in the program. Huge wildfires kept growing today in Oregon and California and spewing giant plumes of smoke and ash. The bootleg fire in southern Oregon is now half the size of Rhode Island. Strong winds have blown smoke from that fire and others all the way to the East Coast, and several major cities have issued air quality alerts. In central China, the death toll rose to at least 25 in catastrophic flooding. Chinese troops blasted open a dam west of hard-hit Zhengzhou, hoping to lower water levels. And more video emerged of subway tunnels being inundated in the city a day earlier. Three trains were at a standstill for more than 40 hours. The Biden administration agreed today to a plan for finishing the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline from Russia to Europe. Previous U.S. administration had argued that it would give Moscow control of European energy supplies. Today's agreement with Germany means that there will be no further U.S. sanctions to block the pipeline.
To potentially undermine our relationship with Germany, and to send a signal to our allies and to our partners the world over that the United States is willing to throw us under important relationships. That's not something that we were eager to do, certainly.
Under the deal, Germany pledges to retaliate if Russia tries to use energy as a weapon. Former movie mogul Harvey Weinstein pleaded not guilty today to rape and sexual assault in Los Angeles. He's accused of attacking five women over 9 years. Weinstein is already serving a 23-year prison term in New York on similar charges. He was extradited yesterday. A federal judge in Arkansas has temporarily blocked a state ban on gender-confirming treatments for transgender youth. The law says that no one under age 18 may receive hormone therapy or related procedures. Today's ruling freezes the law until its fate is decided in court. COVID-19 infections in Tokyo hit a six-month high today, just before the Summer Olympics officially open. Several more athletes also tested positive. Still, the head of the World Health Organization said in Tokyo that the number of infections is less important than the response.
The mark of success in the coming fortnight is not zero cases. And I know that some cases have already been detected. The mark of success is making sure that any cases are identified, isolated, traced, and cared for as quickly as possible.
Olympic competition also began today, so now a spoiler alert. We have the result of the U.S. women's soccer match, one of the first events at these games. The top-ranked Americans were upset by Sweden in their opening match. That ends a 44-game unbeaten run for the U.S. team. They'll try to rebound on Saturday against New Zealand. On Wall Street, corporate earnings reports push stock prices higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 286 points to close at 34,798. The Nasdaq rose 133 points. The S&P 500 added 35. And a first for Major League Baseball. An all-female announcing crew worked a game last night. Baltimore Orioles play-by-play announcer Melanie Newman and MLB analyst Sarah Langs called a game between Baltimore and Tampa Bay. They were joined by three female colleagues. Hooray. Still to come on the NewsHour, a critical legal settlement from major drug companies for their role in the opioid crisis. We preview the next global climate meeting and the goals that must be met. A summer camp aims to maintain connections between daughters and their incarcerated mothers, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The rise of new COVID infections is prompting ever more questions about how people should respond. The CDC added to the sobering picture of the pandemic's impact in the U.S. Life expectancy has fallen by a year and a half. That is the largest one-year decline since World War II. Black and Hispanic Americans were hit the hardest, at times dropping by more than 3 years. The big decline is mainly due to the pandemic. John Yang looks at some of the key questions people are asking now as the Delta variant spreads.
Judy, while new cases are rising in all 50 states, the heaviest concentrations are being reported in the Deep South and a few other states like Missouri. More than 99% of new hospitalizations are among the unvaccinated. And even though deaths remain very low, there's new anxiety about where the pandemic could be headed in this country. Dr. Renit Mashouri is a professor of family medicine at Georgetown University and senior medical advisor to Physicians for Human Rights. She also advises WETA, which owns the NewsHour. Dr. Mashouri, thanks so much for being with us. How concerned should people, especially people who are already fully vaccinated, how concerned should they be about the current situation?
I think we shouldn't freak out, but we should be concerned. The pandemic is not over. It's not over globally, and it's not over in the United States. So I think that some caution, even if you're fully vaccinated, is fully warranted, given how fast and how wide the Delta variant is spreading.
Explain to us how someone who's fully vaccinated could get infected right now, And once infected, how likely is the chance that they'll transmit or pass the virus along?
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is the so-called breakthrough infections. And I want to make sure that people recognize that they are normal and they're expected, and it's not unusual to have breakthrough infections. And there's nothing different about the COVID vaccines and other vaccines in that regard. The vaccines, however, work as they should, and they prevent disease, they prevent hospitalizations and death, as you mentioned. But I would liken it to perhaps wearing a seatbelt in a car. So you're in a car, you put your seatbelt on, you can still get involved in an accident, you could still bump against somebody, but the seatbelt would protect you. You're not going to fly through the windshield. So I think thinking about the COVID vaccine in the same manner, it is very protective. It does a good job at preventing you from getting very sick, from dying, from being hospitalized, but you can still have some, you can still be infected. Most likely, if you are infected, you will either have no symptoms or very, very light symptoms.
Should people who are fully vaccinated go back to start wearing masks? A lot of people stopped once they got the fully vaccine. And the CDC guidelines are that if you're outdoors and indoors, you can go without.
I think it depends on your on one's personal characteristics and the setting. So, for example, I don't wear a mask. I'm fully vaccinated. I don't wear a mask when I'm in my house, when I visit friends who are fully vaccinated, or when I have when I go outside. But I do wear a mask if I'm in a room with other people, many of whom may not be vaccinated or I don't know their vaccination status. I wear a mask inside restaurants and stores. Anytime there is a gathering and you don't know the vaccination status of the people around you, I think it's prudent to wear a mask. Also, if you have family members who are more at risk, children who cannot be vaccinated or sick family members, or you yourself are at a higher risk because you're older or you're immunocompromised, I think all of these situations and settings are is when I would recommend wearing a mask, even if you're fully vaccinated.
Talked about if your immune system is somehow compromised. Should those people be thinking about getting an extra shot, a third dose if you got the mRNA vaccines? And along those lines, are people thinking, what's the latest thinking about booster shots?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most common questions I've been getting these days. You know, with a 50% vaccination rate around the United States and the Delta variant spreading, there is definitely an urgency to get more people vaccinated. But I'm not convinced that a third dose is what we need right now. First of all, the science is not really there about whether it's warranted for the general population. Perhaps it is for vulnerable people or those who are immunocompromised. But I also want to point out something, looking at it through a public health lens or a health equity lens. We need more people in the United States and across the world to get their first and second shot, not to start worrying about getting a third shot. So if you think globally, for example, for every one person being vaccinated in a low-income country, about 117 people get vaccinated in a high-income country. And this is the type of inequity that is hurting all of us. If we want to slow down the pandemic, and I think we all do, the priority should be to get people to get their first and second shots as soon as possible, rather than start worrying about providing a third dose to some people who already had a full dose of the vaccine.
Dr. Renit Mashouri of Georgetown University, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
The consequences of extreme weather are here and unmistakable. Scientists say human-caused climate change is making these events more frequent and severe. Miles O'Brien examines a pivotal upcoming moment in addressing the climate crisis. It is part of our collaboration with Covering Climate Now, a consortium of media organizations reporting on climate change.
There's a new cop on the climate beat, and he's pushing hard to hold the usual suspects accountable. Alok Sharma is president of the 26th Conference of Parties, or COP26. COPs are the summits where the real heavy lifting gets done to mount a global campaign to arrest the climate emergency. COP26 will be held in Glasgow, Scotland this November. Sharma calls it a last chance to avoid the worst effects of climate change.
What do you consider your biggest challenge as president of COP26?
I think the biggest challenge is ensuring that we are persuading countries to come forward with ambitious commitments.
Nearly three quarters of nations in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change have now pledged net zero carbon emissions by 2050.
Everyone needs to play their part. The overarching message that I would like to come out of COP26 is that we have credibly done enough as a world to keep 1.5 within reach.
1.5, as in degrees Celsius, or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. It's the amount of warming above pre-industrial levels set as a desired goal in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, which the Trump administration reneged on and the Biden administration rejoined.
I'm very pleased that we have an administration that is back on the front line in the fight against climate change. I think it was particularly telling that one of the first executive orders that President Biden signed was on rejoining the Paris Agreement. I think this was a real message for the world. The U.S. is back, and the U.S. is going to work alongside other countries in tackling climate change.
The climate has already warmed more than 1 degree Celsius in the industrial era, and the evident effects are multiplying. The heat wave in the Pacific Northwest and the flooding in Germany, just two of the most recent deadly events linked to a warming planet.
The last decade was the hottest on record. And that's why I think it's vital that the world comes together in November so that we can reach agreement, we can reach consensus, and we can say with credibility that we've kept 1.5 alive.
Rich nations have promised to provide $500 billion over 5 years to the developing world to reduce emissions and help them adapt to the consequences of a fast-changing climate, which they shoulder disproportionately for lack of resources to adapt. But so far, the promise has been largely empty. Only a small fraction of the money has been sent.
As I say to all donor countries, if they're able to do more, they certainly should. But what the U.S. does is, of course, going to be vitally important. And I was very impressed with the summit that President Biden organized, where we saw further commitments from countries around the world.
I'm curious if that's part of your strategy to persuade not just the executive branch, but the legislative branch of government.
I think you were seeing across the U.S. in states, both Democrat as well as Republican, a desire for climate action. When I'm again in the U.S., I look forward to meeting a whole range of people and do my bit to try and persuade them of the need to tackle climate change head on.
You know, it seems to me that public opinion is ahead of politicians.
Well, I think basis of the conversations that I've had, I think we have reached that inflection point where there is a shared view, and I think climate has gone mainstream. There are countries that I visit where, in fact, the business community will sometimes be ahead of government policy. And my message to them is that then please tell your government that you are ready for change.
In many cases, the change is happening in spite of political apathy or antipathy. In 2012, 40% of the electricity in the UK was generated by burning coal. Today, it's less than 2%. Wind turbines, many of them offshore, now create a quarter of the electricity here, and that number is on the rise fast.
The world is moving in terms of a clean energy transition. All the G7 nations have stepped forward and said that from this year they will not finance any more coal in countries internationally as well.
Sharma is convinced at COP26 they will consign coal to history's ash bin. He sees it as a key goal for this last chance summit. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien.
It has taken more than 2 years of negotiations, but a number of states have now agreed to a $26 billion settlement with three large drug distributors and Johnson & Johnson for their roles in the opioids epidemic. 500,000 deaths over two decades are attributed to the growth of opioids and fatal overdoses. The settlement would release these companies from legal liability. William Brangham has the details.
The three distributors, Cardinal Health, AmerisourceBergen, and McKesson, are accused of turning a blind eye to enormous suspect shipments of opioids. They'll pay $21 billion over 18 years. Johnson & Johnson, which made an opioid component, was accused of downplaying the addictive properties of their drugs. It will pay $5 billion over 9 years. Many states must now review the settlement, determine how much they'll get, and then decide if they will sign on. For the record, Johnson & Johnson is a funder of the NewsHour. So let's get some perspective from one of the attorneys general who was involved in these negotiations, William Tong of Connecticut. Attorney General Tong, great to have you back on the NewsHour. In the past, you have been a strong critic of other negotiations and settlements with regards to the opioid crisis. Why do you think this one is a strong one?
This one goes to a significant degree to putting necessary funding for treatment and prevention out to cities and towns and states and families and victims across the country. And people need help right now. Other than the pandemic and the COVID crisis, the worst public health crisis in America is the opioid and addiction crisis. And it claims almost 100,000 lives every year across the country, more than 1,000 people, 1,000 families in Connecticut wrecked every single year by the opioid and addiction crisis. And it does more than $10 billion in damage to our state alone. So we need help now. And this is a huge down payment, I would say, for the coming years for every state and every community to try to manage our way through this crisis.
You touched a bit on what some of the money would be used for. Can you tell us a little bit more how that money would be spent? And just as importantly, how do you protect against it getting diverted to non-addiction related sources?
So by its very terms, this very large settlement will go towards abatement. So this $26 billion deal represents the second largest cash settlement in history of any litigation in American history, exceeded only by the big tobacco settlement over 20 years ago. And we wanted to make sure that that money goes directly to treatment, prevention, addiction science, victims and their families, and helping people through the long road to recovery. So by its terms, it directs that money to treatment and prevention, and it makes sure that that money gets to not just states, but we've made provision in this agreement for cities and towns and municipalities that are on the front lines of this battle.
I mean, the companies themselves still argue that they didn't do anything wrong, that they were making and distributing a legal authorized product. And the implication is that this avalanche of lawsuits is what forced them to the negotiating table and now to this settlement. What do you make of that argument?
Look, this settlement provides for a good amount and a good deal of accountability and justice for victims and their families. There's not enough money in the world to erase the pain and the suffering that families across this country have endured from the opioid and addiction crisis. And there isn't enough justice that we can produce for each of these families. But this goes, again, a long way to honoring their pain and suffering by funding treatment and prevention and doing everything we can to provide as much justice as we can. The truth is that the three major drug distributors distribute almost all of the prescription drugs in this country, including all the opioid and prescription pain medication. And they played a central role in moving these pills across the country that were often diverted and overprescribed. Johnson & Johnson played a central role in providing material for producing opioid pain medications and producing their own opioid products. And so the facts are there for everyone to see. And this $26 billion settlement is a recognition of the responsibility that the distributors in Johnson & Johnson must take for their role in this crisis.
As I mentioned before, the states still need to look this over and approve it. That's not a guarantee. Do you think that this amount will be enough to persuade them all to buy in and affirm this deal?
Yes. Again, I know all the states know that this is the second largest cash settlement in history. They know that we've only done better once before, and that was with tobacco. And they know how hard this has been to negotiate this over several years. There have been many times when it wasn't clear this would happen, and the states persevered, and cities and towns. There are more than 4,000 cases pending now in one courtroom, a federal courtroom in Cleveland, Ohio. It's the multi-district litigation court where all the opioid cases are centrally managed. To resolve a case with 56 states, the territories, and the district, and thousands of private plaintiffs in cities and towns with their own claims is such a huge undertaking that only with the full cooperation of almost all the states and their attorneys general, Democrats, Republicans, and cities and towns and plaintiffs and victims across the country, only with everyone's hard work and combined effort could we get to this point. And so I have a lot of confidence that from this point forward, everyone will see how important a deal this is and that people will embrace and ratify it.
Separately, as you well know, Purdue Pharmaceuticals, the maker of OxyContin, is in separate negotiations where they will declare bankruptcy, reorganize their corporation, and pay upwards of $4 billion. Some states have been saying, yes, we like the contours of this deal. Where do you come down on that?
I'm a hard no on this deal, and I'm joined by eight other states who reject this deal because it does not provide enough justice. The Sacklers take no responsibility for their role, their singular role in the opioid and addiction crisis. And this money just isn't enough relative to the amount of pain and damage the Sacklers have caused.
All right. Attorney General William Tong of the state of Connecticut, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Estimates show that more than 5 million children in the U.S. have had an incarcerated parent. As the number of women behind bars in America soars, little is known about the impact on the children the women leave behind. Amna Nawaz went to Texas to meet some of those children and report on how one organization is keeping young girls connected with their mothers. It's part of our ongoing series, Searching for Justice.
How was your day, Mom?
It was good. How was yours?
It was good.
For 1 hour every month.
Later, you better show me your outfit, okay?
This is 12-year-old Lila Edwards' only contact with her mom, Lina Acosta.
You look beautiful today. Thank you, Mom.
You always look beautiful.
Thank you. You too, Mom.
Lila was only two in 2011 when her mom was sentenced to 40 years in prison for murder. Lila now lives in Dallas with her grandparents and nine other family members. Her mom's prison is 2 hours away in Gatesville, Texas. She hasn't been able to visit at all during the pandemic.
Do you know when you're going to see her next?
No.
No? Is that hard to think about sometimes?
Yeah.
Aw, that's pretty.
Staying connected over video calls is hard. But on this day, Lila was all smiles.
Yes.
Excited to talk about a unique camp she's been attending for the last few years.
I'm really excited.
Really excited?
Yeah.
How long ago did you start packing?
2 weeks ago.
Why are you so excited for camp?
Because it's really fun over there.
Come over here.
Organized by the nonprofit Girls Embracing Mothers, or GEM, the camp brings together about 20 girls, all of whom have mothers that are either currently or formerly incarcerated.
Children with incarcerated parents are among the most at-risk, yet least visible, populations of children.
Brittany Barnett is an attorney in Dallas and the founder of GEM. Her own mother spent 2.5 years in the Texas state prison system on drug charges.
What are these girls missing while their mothers are in prison that you're trying to help them get?
Love, empowerment, encouragement. I remember visiting my mom for the first time in prison and not being able to touch her because we had to visit through the glass, and just being devastated of my mom being so close yet so far away.
Across the country, women make up the fastest growing segment of the incarcerated population. Over the last 40 years, the number of women behind bars has skyrocketed by more than 700%. In Texas, which locks up more women than any other state, roughly 80% of female inmates are mothers. Barnett says despite those numbers, very little is known about the children of incarcerated mothers.
We don't hear a lot about them. There's a lack of data at even the number of children who have a parent incarcerated in Texas. We don't know. I don't understand how this country can invest $80 billion a year in incarceration and not track the outcomes and the data and the collateral consequences of mass incarceration, which are children.
Welcome to Gem Camp.
The Gem Camp is a refuge held in the woods just outside of Dallas. The goal, Barnett says, is to show these girls, some as young as 7, that they're not alone.
I'm going to 4th grade, and I've been in gyms, I think, since I was about 6.
Hi, I'm Zoe. I'm 14, and I'm going to the 10th grade.
Experts say this kind of support is crucial to breaking the cycle of incarceration. Children with incarcerated parents are at greater risk of dropping out of school, of experiencing mental health issues, and homelessness. All factors that also put them at greater risk of being incarcerated themselves.
Hey, burrito!
But every year, for 3 summer days, this camp is their home.
Taco Bell! Taco Bell!
In many ways, the camp is like any other summer camp. The girls bunk in cabins.
Okay, scoot to the right.
They do trust-building exercises. They go swimming. And of course, there's a campfire and s'mores. But when I sat down with a group of girls, they shared what this camp family really means to them.
I've been in GEMS for 3 or 4 years.
Emma Stubblefield is 17. When her mom went to prison 5 years ago, the GEM program kept them connected with regular visits pre-pandemic. Her mother was released in 2019.
We were really close, but then she went to prison and just kind of like fell apart. And then with GEMS, I was able to like get back with her, and now we're really, really close.
This is Chloe Kerr. She's 14.
How old were you when your mom went to prison?
3.
You were 3. And how long was she inside?
She was in until I was 12.
On the outside, like when you tell people that your mom's in jail, they automatically think that she's a bad person. But everybody here understands.
What do they understand?
That just because you did something bad doesn't mean you're a bad person.
The counselors here understand too. They're all volunteers, and many were formerly incarcerated, including Brittany's mom, Evelyn Fulbright, now a nurse at a drug rehabilitation center. She was released nearly 13 years ago in 2008, but to this day, she still remembers the inmate number given to her by the Texas Department of Criminal Justice.
A bittersweet number, 1374671. But no matter what my TDC number was, I was still her mom. And it's great to have support. It's great to not feel alone. And we watch them girls when they come into the program, when they meet other little girls that are going through the same thing, we watch them not be so timid or shy or ashamed.
Today, Sharonda Jones runs the camp kitchen. She's been volunteering here since she was released more than 5 years ago, after serving 16 years of a life sentence for a drug conspiracy conviction.
It made me think about my daughter and the times that I was gone, because when I left, she was 8. So that's a different feeling. These are little girls, and a lot of time when you're at school, you shame, you're not talking about this. So to bring them together like this and make it complete for them, like understanding each other, makes my day.
She's free now because Barnett fought for her, advocating for 6 years to get her released until President Barack Obama granted Jones clemency in 2015. Barnett documented that fight in her memoir last year, A Knock at Midnight. In total, Barnett's helped free more than 30 of her clients facing life sentences for drug crimes.
I see her and I have such a mixed batch of emotions of just happiness that she's free, sadness to even think that the laws of this country would allow her to be sentenced to life, and to think about what that means. Sharonda Jones was serving the same amount of time in prison as the Unabomber. What sense does that make?
The camp is a source of comfort for the girls, but counselors push them to consider what they're really capable of. Over an hour after her first attempt at archery, Lila learns what she can do. And 17-year-old Natalie Elizardo pens her first lines of poetry ever.
I am strong. I am not an object to be locked away, but a woman who pushes through these challenges and comes out stronger. I am my mother's daughter. I am Natalie.
Natalie's mother, Sonia Lopez, served 6 months in prison and was released in 2016, just 2 months before she passed away.
Well, my mom went through a lot of things raising us. She raised 5 kids alone, so she really had to find strength in herself to be able to take care of us.
And she passed that down to you?
Yeah.
You know that about yourself. Does it feel good to write this on paper and say it out loud?
Yeah. I've been through like a lot of hard things in my life, so I like to believe that I'm stronger than before I had to go through them.
Barnett knows the camp is an escape. After 3 days here, the girls go home, and the struggle to stay connected to their mothers continues.
We can only do what we can to help reduce the trauma that is a result of maternal incarceration. And the bond and the love between the mothers and daughters in our program is unconditional. You know, they're our mamas. They're much more than a 7-digit prison number assigned by the Texas Department of Criminal Justice.
Guys, big hug, big hug, big hug.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz in Dallas.
With summer in full swing, you may be wondering what books to take along on vacation or enjoy right at home. Jeffrey Brown talks with two writers who have answers to that question. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Books helped many of us get through the last year. To help us keep up the reading as we head into summer, we're joined by Glory Edom, founder of the book club Well-Read Black Girl. Her new anthology on girlhood comes out this fall. And Maureen Corrigan, book critic for NPR's Fresh Air and a professor at Georgetown University. And it's nice to see both of you. Glory, you want to start with some fiction?
Oh, wow. Right now, I'm obsessed with Caitlin Greenidge's Liberty. It's a great book, just full of rich historical detail. It's inspired by the first black doctors during the Reconstruction era. Mm-hmm. And she takes us on this beautiful ride, learning about the young woman who is like trying to find herself, full of great detail. Also, when it comes to fiction, I'm loving rom-coms. So Jasmine Gilroy has a new book coming out, as well as Tia Williams. Tia Williams's book is called 7 Days in June, and it is that kind of story where you feel like you're talking to your best friend, and a little bit of cringy moments, but like a lot of heartfelt laughter and joy. It's a great title.
Maureen Corrigan, give us a few fiction novels.
The writer I hope everybody will read, especially if they've never read her before, is Lori Colwin. Lori Colwin died in the 1990s. She wrote 5 novels, 2 short story collections, and 2 collections of food writing. She is wonderful. She is smart. She is so funny and droll and emotionally complex. And 2 of her publishers are reprinting everything she wrote. So I would grab Family Happiness and any of her other wonderful novels to really celebrate what we hope is the end of this pandemic. The other book I'd recommend for the summer is The Final Revival of Opal and Nev by Donnie Walton. It's a wonderful kind of simulacrum of a rock oral history. And so it's fun to read because lots of different styles, but also very moving about people trying to pursue their dreams and what they do to try to achieve those dreams.
How about a couple of nonfiction picks?
Oh,
Lori?
I am reading Somebody's Daughter by Ashley Ford right now, mm-hmm. and it is really insightful. It looks at Ashley's life as she is trying to really understand what has happened between her and her father. Her father was incarcerated, and she's like coming of age and trying to really mend their relationship. It's a very endearing book. I'm also reading Goodbye Again by Johnny Sun, and that's a collection of essays and reflections, and he has stories looking at plants and thinking about what they mean and where they are in the world, or leaving home and being in another space and what it means to welcome others into your home and what you call home. He does a great job of just like welcoming the reader in.
Now, Maureen, before we start, you told me you were really immersed in fiction, but how about a couple of nonfiction picks?
Yeah, I have a few picks. Republic of Detours by mm-hmm. Scott Borchert just came out, and it's about the Federal Writers Project during the Great Depression. Government wanted to put broke writers to work and came up with this idea of putting people to work, writing guides to all of the then 48 states. People like Ralph Ellison, Zora Neale Hurston, John Cheever, they were put to work on this project. It's an amazing story, tons of wonderful anecdotes and really vivid writing. I also would recommend Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's Notes on Grief mm-hmm. For people who want to get in touch with, again, some of the heavier emotions of this period that we've just been through. She's writing about the death of her father. You know, she's a spectacular writer, and she really probes those emotions of what it means when life just feels really fragile.
I wonder what you see happening now in terms of reading impact from the last year or publication impact.
The last few months have been the most diverse list of books that I've seen in my 30 plus years as a reviewer. So I do think that there's much more of a responsiveness on the part of the publishing industry to begin to try to diversify what has been historically a very white industry. And, you know, the other thing that's happening that's so interesting, I'm a big fan of suspense fiction. Mm-hmm. And I would say that almost every suspense novel that I pick up these days has a plot line about cultural appropriation or appropriation of someone else's words. The Plot by Jean Hanf Korelitz, who's a wonderful suspense writer. The plot takes place in an MFA program, a lot of resentment and bad behavior, but also then this plot about a man appropriating a woman's words. Mm-hmm. The Other Black Girl by Zakiah Delilah Harris mm-hmm. is also a story about appropriation in part. It's about a young woman of color in the publishing industry, again, historically a very white industry, but it's got this kind of subplot about stealing someone else's story. So I think there's this paranoia out there about people not having control of their own stories, really filtering into suspense fiction.
And Glory, what trends do you see happening now?
I would agree with Maureen. There is this wave of diversity that's happening and more voices that are focusing on, cultural appropriation, race relations. I am a huge fan of The Other Black Girl. I read that as well. And it also feels like it's more character driven, and there's more essay collections that are also coming out too. I feel like I've been reading so many great essay collections that are focused on abstract topics and memoirs that are not linear in fashion. They're really more experimental and avant-garde in nature. And I think it's great. I think we can do more experimentation when it comes to publishing in that space.
All right, Glory Edom, Maureen Corrigan, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we close with how the city of Milwaukee is celebrating its first national basketball championship in 50 years. It's a delirious moment for a city and a smaller market team that had finished short of its expectations for several years. Milwaukee last won with the great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, known then as Lou Alcindor, and Oscar Robertson. Fans are cheering the team and the new superstar leader, who became just the seventh player in NBA history to score 50 or more points in a finals game. Stephanie Tsai has the story.
It's over. The Bucks have done it. The long wait has ended. After a half century, the Milwaukee Bucks are NBA champions once again.
A city ecstatic. The Milwaukee Bucks lifting up the Larry O'Brien Trophy, defeating the Phoenix Suns 105-98 in Game 6 of the NBA Finals. Bucks star Giannis Antetokounmpo scored 50 points, snatched 14 rebounds, and posted 5 blocks in a virtuoso performance, earning him the Finals MVP award. On his big night, the superstar remembered where it all began.
I started playing basketball just to, you know, help my family, you know, try to get them out of the struggle, you know, the challenges we were facing when we were kids. I never thought ever when I'd be 26, you know, I'd be sitting in this chair with this right here and this right here.
Born in Greece to Nigerian parents, Antetokounmpo and his brother sold trinkets on the streets to survive. He faced racism and hardship. But in Greece today, he's a hero. At the Kivotos Cafe, where a teenage Antetokounmpo used to grab juice and a sandwich before basketball practice, they celebrate.
Antetokounmpo has brought not only basketball, but sporting role models back to this generation. He's no longer Giannis from Sapolia. At this moment, he's Giannis of the entire world.
He first made a name for himself playing in Athens and became known in the NBA as the Greek Freak for his 6 foot 11 inch frame combined with explosive athleticism. A force to be sure, but he didn't pull off the championship alone. Chris Middleton made key plays in the Bucks' playoff run. Middleton and Antetokounmpo have played 8 seasons together. After Giannis's initial contract with the Bucks expired, there were rumors he might leave. But the two-time MVP vowed to stay with Milwaukee. And last night, it paid off.
8 and a half years ago, before I came to the league, I didn't know where my next move will come from. You know, my mom was selling stuff in the street. And now I'm here, sitting in the top of the top. Don't let nobody tell you what you can be, what you cannot do. You know, people told me I can't make free throws. I made my free throws tonight, and I'm a freaking champion.
Woo! I've been up like this.
And freaking hungry.
Can I have, please, a 50-piece Mac Minis? 50, exactly. Okay. Not 51, not 49. Chicken Minis, yes. 50.
To honor snapping a 50-year title drought with a 50-point performance, a drive-through meal for the champ. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
And you've got to feel uplifted by that, no matter which team you're for. And on the NewsHour online right now, we look at 4 sports making their debut at the Tokyo Olympics and the aim to draw younger fans to the games. You can find that on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.